Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to the March edition of Wireless here on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. A warm welcome also to our listeners on Phoenix FM in Dublin, Claremorris Community Radio in Mayo, Wired FM in Limerick, West Cork FM and WGXC in Columbia County, New York. Wireless is the radio programme all about radio, local, regional and national broadcasters, pirate and free radio, DAB and podcasting and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on this month's programme, independent Irish radio broadcasters protest against government policy. Two community radio stations come together to form the new West Cork FM. Highlights from World Radio Day last month and another extract from the Irish Pirate Radio Audio Archive.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Independent Broadcasters of Ireland, the organisation representing 34 independent commercial stations, last week told politicians that it had lost patience with the failure of government to address issues facing Irish broadcasting. The IBI claims that huge unregulated corporations such as Facebook and Google are undermining both commercial radio and democracy itself, and it accused the government of failing to act on promises about the reform of broadcasting, journalism and public service programming. At the same time, Fianna Fáil proposed to the introduction of a public service broadcast fund for independent radio. We're joined on the phone now by John Purcell of KCLR FM in Kilkenny, who is also chair of IBI. John, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much, John.
Can you tell us a little bit about the background to this IBI campaign and what exactly are you complaining about?
Well, I suppose the background is the revolution that's taken place in media, brought about largely by the disruption caused to traditional business models in advertising-funded media by the advent of Facebook and Google, I suppose, are the two main ones. It's had huge disruption. Radio is enormously popular in Ireland. It has remained so, but the business model has been disrupted. And so there's pressure on maintaining the output that people know and love. About 70%, just under 70% of time spent listening to radio in Ireland is to independent radio. And while the listenership is strong, the business model is just shot to pieces. It's something we've been saying to governments, successive governments, going back many years, and nothing has happened. Hence our impatience and the statement that you referred to in your introduction. So that's the context, really.
And what are the broken promises that you're referring to in your statement, the things that government haven't done?
Well, number one, the 9th of February, but earlier this week, as I speak to you, marked 3 years since the government, since the last general election. One of the key promises made by then Taoiseach Enda Kenny was the abolition of the broadcasting levy, something that was introduced in 2009, just on the eve of the financial meltdown. We were given clear and unambiguous promises in relation to that, and they haven't delivered on them yet. We think we have been patient. 3 years is a long time. We feel there's ample time has passed to deliver on that promise, and we're very frustrated that it hasn't happened. That's one element of it. The other area is in relation to something that we've been pressing for a long time, which is the development of a fund funded by the licence fee to help in the sustaining of news, current affairs, sports and talk programming on independent radio. And that's something we've been asking for quite a while. The Joint Oireachtas Committee on Communications came out mid last year and said that they supported that. RTÉ are in favour of it. We're in favour of it. And yet nothing has happened.
You said earlier that the business model is broken and has been broken by social media, essentially. That prompts the question, well, does the business model need to change? And perhaps the problem is the business model rather than the competition from others.
Well, if you can think of a business model where you can produce media that is balanced, fair, produced by professional journalists, and you can do so without money, we welcome to see that. But the problem is basically for paid for or advertising supported content. is all flowing towards the digital operators. And what's more, not only the business model, but the regulatory model as well is not fit for purpose. I mean, television, traditional free-to-air television and radio are both regulated by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, for example, and we're bound by the Broadcasting Act and all the various provisions of fairness, balance, decency, taste, you know, advertising standards and so on. Stuff that just simply doesn't apply to Facebook in particular, who thumb their nose at, you know, democratically elected institutions who try to hold them to account.
So are you saying that you need less government regulation then? Is that the case?
No, because I'm not necessarily saying we need less government regulation, but the operators have been described last week in the Cairncross report published by the British Parliament, a very significant piece of work, as digital pirates. I mean, Facebook in particular are operating without any regulatory oversight, not only in Ireland but around the world, and something needs to be done about that. You know, you hardly need me to rehearse the issues about fake news and the misuse of data, the extremely shady practices used to interfere with elections and so on. But, you know, an operator like myself in KCLR would not get away with that under the regulatory system that we face. I'm not under any illusions that we will determine the outcome of national elections, but at the same time, you know, people in the digital sphere can seem to get away with that kind of stuff. There needs to be a grasping of that particular nettle, and the playing field needs to be levelled for the survival of proper journalism and proper journalistic standards.
But is there an argument perhaps that the product itself needs to change? I mean, 30 years after the legalisation of independent radio in Ireland, is the product perhaps a bit stale at this stage in the commercial sector?
Look, I'm not arguing against change at all. Change and innovation and adaptation is completely necessary. You know, in the radio station where I work, video is part of our everyday work. We operate on multiple platforms, we're available on apps and all that sort of stuff. But in a context whereby revenue has shrunk by, you know, up to 50% over the last 10 years, it's very difficult to fund that innovation and to fund change, you know, because people are under pressure. You know, people, you know, I think it's 83% of Irish people listen to radio every day. Sure, I'd love to be able to invest in more innovation, but without a source of funding, that's very difficult. And that's why we're asking for this fund from the licensee, which would be used for news and current affairs to sustain what we have, but also to allow us to grow and innovate and provide balanced, fair and good local coverage, which, you know, there was a very good debate in the Dáil about it, and speaker after speaker testified to the importance and the power and the positivity that particularly local radio brings to the media landscape.
And obviously you can't speak for other traditional media, but is there a case that, you know, all traditional media should be supported by a public service broadcast fund? Obviously, I'm talking to you from a community radio station, which far more cash starved than any of the commercial stations are.
Well, I think, as I understand it, the community sector has a large part, is based on volunteerism, is also based on you know, community development goals and so on. So I think it's apples and oranges to an extent. But broadcast media that performs a public function and a good public function, to me, deserves to be supported, yeah.
John Purcell of IBI and of KCLR FM in Kilkenny, thanks very much for speaking to us today.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
West Cork has a long and proud radio tradition stretching back to the pirate days of the 1980s, so it's perhaps unsurprising that a new group has come together to form a community radio station for that area. Two separate stations, Gateway FM and Atlantic Radio, were both serving West Cork online and through temporary FM licences, but they've recently amalgamated to form a new station, West Cork FM. Station manager Paul Broderick told me about the background to the project.
And I suppose the precursor on this side of it was Gateway FM, which I know that you are a little bit familiar with. But the project in Bandon actually started up in 2014. A guy by the name of Richard Conroy was the driving force behind that for many years before he unfortunately passed away untimely, as it was 2 years ago. So Richard would have worked with me back in the days of the Pirates back in the 80s with WKLR. Both of us are ex-WKLR people. And it was always on his radar for me to join the group. And little did I know that a year after him bringing me in, that I'd be taking up the mantle and running with it after him passing away. So that was the precursor to Gateway FM. It started its life as Bandon Community Radio. And I always thought that that was a little bit too parochial, too close. And I also have an idea that, or had the idea, that a station just for a small town like Bandon wouldn't be sustainable in the longer term. So the idea was formed that West Cork Local Radio, as it was WKNR back in the day, really provided what was a community service. It was way ahead of its time, and that we should really aspire to actually broadcasting to the whole of West Cork, being a regional in its own right. It's a recognised geographic region. It's also recognised as a political region. Cork South West is the electoral area down here. And there's a lot of... West Cork is unique, I suppose, in lots of ways. But it is really an area in its own right and identifiable. People identify as West Cork people when you ask somebody where they're from. Oh, I'm from West Cork. So for that reason, we decided to expand that. Clonakilty then coming on board, the Atlantic Radio guys, that started off as Clonline Radio and morphed into Atlantic Radio Ireland then. And I had an approach from Barry through actually the chair of our group is Gillian Coughlin. She's an elected member of Cork County Council. She was a member of the group before she actually joined the council, but she made representations to both of us, and Barry made contact with me then, and we had a chat, and we decided, yep, this is what we're both about. It was really providing a community radio service for West Cork, and yeah, it just went from there.
And WKLR, I mean, we're quite familiar with that here, and we have covered WKLR as well as many other pirate stations. So is that actually the model then for the station, Paul? The pirate of 30 years ago, are many of, or at least some of the people who were involved then still behind West Cork FM?
There are a number of them, yes. No, none of the guys that would have been involved from the Atlantic side would have had any history with WKLR, but... on our side, we have our regular Saturday afternoon broadcaster, John O'Mahony. He was there. Our guy that used to do drive time in the evening time on a Saturday, he's gone back to breakfast time in the morning, Donal O'Donovan. He used to be on the air as Ian Andrews. And John Daly, who was one of our regular broadcasters as well, he was there for 2 years. He started off in 1984 and left in 86 and went down to Horizon and Clarendon and did a couple of other tours down around Kerry before eventually settling back in Cork.
There is a tradition, I suppose, of radio in the area that you're drawing on then to set up West Cork FM.
There certainly is, and I'd say to model ourselves on WKLR probably wouldn't be factually correct, I suppose, but certainly there was a lot of things that WKNR did and did very, very well. And one of those, and we've already achieved that in a small way since we've gone on the air ourselves, is actually getting out into the community and doing local broadcasting actually from the streets, from, you know, local halls, from whatever. Like last year there now for Ballabwee, for example, which is the traditional horse festival, the horse fair down in Dunmanway, which takes place around the August Bank Holiday weekend, racing and all that down there. And this year, just gone by 2018, they revitalized the busking festival, which they had there for many years. So on the Wednesday of the festival, we were actually out on the street. We were out on stage. We were broadcasting live on the internet, online. And we had something like, I'd say, 14, 15, maybe up to 20 different acts and groups actually playing around the square, from young people from the age of 6, 7 years of age right up to there was guys in their 70s and 80s playing there. And we went around with those. We did an interview with each one of them, and each one of them got to play at least one tune, or maybe even two if they were good enough. So we recorded all that and put it together as a podcast, but it went out live as well. And that's the kind of programming that I'd like to see us doing more of. We're after, to that end, next Saturday, for example, we're actually outside. We're doing the reopening of the revamped Supervalue in Dunmanway, and there's a big program of events going on with that. But in part of that as well, to get out to festivals and things like that, we've actually gone and agreed for the purchase of WLR, Waterford Local Radio's old outside broadcast unit. So we're hoping to have that on the road very, very shortly as well, as a fully kitted out mobile studio. So that's the kind of broadcasting that we're talking about doing, right? Getting out into the community, getting connected with people, and giving them an opportunity to get their voices and get their music and get themselves heard on the airwaves of West Cork.
So it's very much the original community radio style broadcasting being out there on the road. Are you interested in some of the philosophies behind community radio as well that you hear about through the AMARC group and so on, this kind of local democracy and participation and allowing marginal groups and minorities to get involved? Is that on your radar as well?
It is, and I think that's very, very important. And actually, interestingly enough, as part of my remit, I've been actually working with the group in Bear Island and setting up their radio station.
Yeah, we covered them as well recently.
Yeah, they're about to go on the air very shortly. Now, they've missed a couple of dates for different reasons, but that's a slightly different project. But through that, I was actually down with them there, and the guys from AMARC, and there was guys from Romania, and guys behind the actual project, which is the Grassroots Radio Project, and UCC, there was a whole gang of people down there, so it was a great opportunity to mix and mingle and get an idea of that and actually meet some of these people face-to-face as well, which was great. But certainly any of the talks that we actually had down there and discussions that we had, maybe even over a few pints, really reinforced that with me, that what we were doing and our approach to it was absolutely correct and falls in with AMARC, of course. Being members of CRAIL and as a requirement for the licence, you do have to sign up to the AMARC charter. But I don't think that AMARC is doing anything different or looking for anything different than what we would hope to achieve ourselves in West Cork.
And you said that you were on online only, but your plan is to go on FM under a temporary licence arrangement with the BAI. So obviously you feel that FM is still very necessary at a local level and that online isn't enough?
I would say that, yeah. And it's certainly, when you look at the likes of Norway, for example, who've gone completely digital, that has been trialled in West Cork, has been trialled in Cork at the moment. It's not really the way to go. The online side of it, while we've been growing our listenership online, and that's without doing any kind of massive promotion, either in the papers or, you know, through other media like Facebook and that, purely because as we're just trying to establish ourselves and lay the groundwork for it, we didn't want to be promoting ourselves or pushing ourselves too much, not being able to, we'll say, deliver what we were seeking to achieve. But certainly traditionally, I'm looking at even radio usage in around just even the locality, people still have a very close association and relationship with their standard FM radio, and I don't see that changing, certainly in the short term, unless there's something now like Norway where it is actually driven from a government side, where they're forced down a digital road. But I can't see that happening in Ireland in the next 5-10 years at the very earliest.
Certainly digital is not a runner in Ireland at the moment at all. So your plan is for a 100-day licence from the BAI, is that right?
That's right. We did, in Gateway FM, we actually did a 30-day licence, which finished in January of last year, 2018. And through that, we felt that 30-day licence, we misread or misunderstood, I suppose, the information that was there from the BAI. And we had applied for a second 30-day licence within the 12 months. And after 4 or 6 weeks, they came back and said, no, this is your second application within 12 months. You can't have that. You have to wait until your 12 months is up. Which we didn't, that wasn't certainly the impression that we were under, because the sustainability of this, if you want to actually put a service on the air, there's no point, I think, okay, if you're trialing something at the beginning and trying to get used to something and whatever and building something up, maybe a 30-day license is okay. 30-day license is okay for the likes of Christmas FM, who are just broadcasting for the month of December, or if you're just covering maybe a couple of festivals or you want something on just for a week for a local festival or something like that, that's absolutely fine as well. Bear Island, it suits them exactly for that project at the moment, and it certainly suited our purpose at the start as well. But if you actually want to build it up over a period of time, the sustainability of that and people's loyalties and things like that, if you don't have something regular, if you don't have something all the time, they lose interest in it and becomes kind of a thing, oh, sure, they're only missing, they're only part-time broadcasters, you know, sure, they're here today, they're gone tomorrow. If that's the kind of attitude that people adopt, it's very hard to change that. So our attitude was, we kept our whole group together. So the people that were actually broadcasting for the 30-day license, the whole group stayed together, with coming on board now with the Atlantic Radio gang and forming West Cork FM. So we've actually just broadened our schedule and amalgamating those programs into our schedule. So it means that actually when it comes to going on the air in June, or even if it's July, we don't care, it will be a 100-day license, and we'll already have that schedule in place before we start. So that was a very important thing for us, that we actually kept that team together, and now the fact that we've expanded it and that we keep that sustainable going forward, I think we'll be able to build up that relationship now with people going forward with the 100-day licence when we get that underway.
And is the plan then to be a full-time community radio station for West Cork eventually?
Eventually, yes. Like, I would have a 3-year plan in my head. Well, we need to sit down and actually flesh that out as a group. Certainly, my hope would be that eventually it would become a full-time station. Certainly, the population of West Cork and the amount of business that's there in West Cork certainly is there to sustain something of a full-time nature. When you look at, and we all aspire to y'all, and a lot of us would be very jealous of the gang down in CRY, certainly just because it's another local group, they're the other side of the county, and certainly they have state-of-the-art services and studios and all that down there, but they have been going for 35 years. But certainly if you can do it in East Cork, there's no reason why we can't do it in West Cork.
Is transmission an issue on the community radio licence side? Because the power of community radio is generally quite low, maybe 100 watts, perhaps 200, maybe 250 watts maximum. So would that cause issues in an area as large geographically as West Cork?
It does indeed. And certainly, even though that I've been speaking to a number of radio companies, the companies that actually provide services to other radio stations, and one of them in particular mentioned one particular radio station elsewhere in Munster that are using much bigger powers than that. Now, they would have been previously, speaking about Tip Midwest, they would have been previously a licensed station before the licensing was changed for Tipperary, and they subsequently became a community radio station. But certainly they were using much bigger powers than what the BEA and Comrig normally license community radio stations for. And this perception that they have, like that it's a community radio station, should be only kind of accessible kind of 8 to 10 kilometres range, which is about the power that you're talking about, kind of 50 watts, 100 watts, depending on your aerial stacks and all the rest of it. That's not really sustainable in the longer term, I don't think. It might be different now for, let's say, a college radio or something like that, where you're broadcasting to a campus or around the city. And when you take that into a city context, for the likes of Galway, for the likes of Limerick, for the likes of the Dublin stations, like a 5 to 10 mile radius for them can get you quarter of a million people, possibly.
Yeah.
Now, whereas you take that into West Cork, where it has a population of, let's say, roughly about 160,000, 170,000 people, you know, and to actually do that with the terrain that's there, it's virtually impossible to do it. You couldn't do it from one particular site, and you certainly couldn't do it with the kind of power ratios that they're talking about. So our overall plan there and what we're looking at and what we put through with this application is, we're not expecting that they'll accept a whole lot of it, but that we'll have one main site with reasonable power, which will be designed to cover the Manway and cover cars, basically for the whole of West Cork, which will get good car coverage, but then using smaller local infill transmitters, kind of up to maximum 50 watts, maybe 100 watts in places, to cover the main towns. And that should give us good coverage around those areas.
Paul Broderick, station manager of the new West Cork FM, telling us about the background to the station and its future plans. And you can find out more at westcorkfm.ie.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
World Radio Day was held as usual on February the 13th, and this year's theme was Dialogue, Tolerance and Peace. The aims of the day are to celebrate radio as a medium, to foster international cooperation between broadcasters, and to encourage radio stations to promote access to information, freedom of expression and gender equality. Many community stations in Ireland marked the day with special broadcasts, including ourselves. Here's an interview we did with Ari Hautaniemi of Limu Radio, a community and college station in Lahti in Finland.
Flirt Newsfeed. Global.
Tell me first a bit about you and how you got involved in radio.
My name is Ari Hautaniemi. I work as a development manager at the Lahti University of Applied Sciences at the Faculty of Technology. Most of my tasks include different kinds of EU-funded development projects and teaching, but I also run the student/community radio station called Limu Radio. I'm also honored to be the current president of the World College Radio Day Network, which is a voluntary organization aimed at promoting networking of student radio stations around the world and giving voice to this alternative, independent and oftentimes innovative form of media.
Can you tell me a bit about Limu Radio?
My first touch of radio came when I was a pimple-faced teenager. I really, really enjoyed listening to small local radio station that we had here in Lahti. All the DJs were very fun and the music they played was very interesting. And that's when I grew to be in love with this kind of old school radio. But as times evolved and the world around us changed, so did radio. And that pretty much meant that I had to find that same radio spirit somewhere else. So I turned to independent alternative stations online in the mid-90s, and I've been listening to them ever since. And in 2013, me and a couple of colleagues of mine, we were listening to one of these American college radio stations with some fine music and excellent babble. And we were just pondering that why don't we have this kind of culture here in Finland? And at that time, we didn't know about other student radio stations here at our country. So we just decided to go ahead and try to build our own. So we got a small funding from our university. It was about 200 euros, I guess. And we gathered a bunch of students around us to make our own radio station. And it all started with typing in Google, how do you start your own radio station? So we had no experience. We had no idea what we were doing, but we just wanted to do it. So that's how Limu Radio got started. Limu Radio now is probably the most active student radio station in Finland, or at least one of the most active ones. We operate online. In 2013, we established our studio with loaned equipment at a local cleaning closet. I literally mean that. It was a cleaning closet where we built our studio. But nowadays, we have our fully operational 24/7 online studio at our campus here in Lahti. At the first stage, there were 8 students involved, and now there's around 60 to 70 students or other community members involved in doing Limu Radio. Well, what we mostly do is music shows. That's probably one of the biggest reasons why students get involved in doing radio. They love some kind of music and they want others to, they want to share their passion. And that's what our station mostly is about. It's about different kinds of music genres and doing some work around that. We operate mostly live, but we also do pre-recorded shows. And we have some program swapping with other radio stations here in Finland also.
What is student radio like in Finland?
Student radio in Finland is, there are about a dozen student radio stations in Finland. When I compare them to other stations in Europe, we are quite well equipped technically. We are quite ready to do online radio compared to, for example, many American stations that have to adjust their operations to work in an online environment. But the biggest problem is that student radio as a medium isn't that well established here in Finland. The public doesn't really know that we exist, and we don't collaborate as much as we could. When we look at Sweden, for example, they have their own student radio stations, have their own union, which of course makes things easier. It's much easier to get funds and raise public awareness about student radio in general, its role and its importance in the media landscape. But we have some great shows, and one of our quirks or one of the fun things here in the Finnish student radio landscape is these festive radios, which only air 1 or 2 weeks, perhaps 1 or 2 days during the Vappu period. Vappu is the 1st of May, which is a big student festival here in Finland, also known as the Workers' Day. There's a lot of drinking, a lot of having fun, sort of like a bank holiday in UK, but it's a free day for everyone, and it's a big thing for universities and students, and some stations are there just for that specific time of year.
In 2016, Lati hosted the first international studio radio event. What was that like and who was involved?
In 2016, yeah, we hosted the first international student radio conference, Alternatives. It went surprisingly well. We didn't really know who would actually come here in distant Lahti in Finland. We sent out invitations to all over the world for student radio people, students, researchers, teachers, station managers, also journalists and other enthusiasts. We didn't know if anyone would come here in Lahti to join this event. But we got almost 80 people from all over the world involved, and that was amazing. The conference had two objectives. The first one was to share knowledge and ideas about student, college or university radio around the world. I know many stations out there work in their own little bubble where they have little contact with other student radio stations, and many stations have challenges and problems which other stations have already fixed. So the chance for people from different countries or different continents to discuss these challenges and solutions would be beneficial to student radio as a whole. Also, the other big thing was to actually start building international networks of student radio stations and student radio people. And that has actually paid off quite well. This year, there is going to be another Alternatives event. We actually thought that Alternatives 2016 was a one-time thing, but luckily people from United States and from the World College Radio Day organization decided that it was very fruitful and it is worth continuing. So with the help of Dr. Rob Quick from the William Patterson University, we've been able to do Alternatives again.
You now have another event coming up in Cambridge this year. Who's this aimed at and what can they expect?
So in Cambridge this year, we are organizing Alternatives again. The most work is done by William Patterson University, but of course, the World College Radio Day organization is helping as well. The event is aimed again at all kinds of people who are involved in doing student, college, or university radio. The big thing, again, is to share information, share research and practical knowledge about doing student media in this time. And the more people we get, the better networks we are able to bind. People can expect a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of like-minded people, and a fantastic landscape.
And where can people keep up with information about World College Radio, LIMU and Alternatives?
If you want to know more about World College Radio Day or Alternatives Conference, you should definitely go like our Facebook page. And also, if you want to know what LIMU Radio is up to, you can go like our Facebook page and perhaps tune in to LIMU Radio at www.limuradio.fi. Most of our shows are in Finnish, so it will be quite an experience for all of you. Thank you. Have a happy World Radio Day.
Flirt Newsfeed. Global.
And that was Ari Hautaniemi of LIMU Radio in Finland speaking to Owen Holland about World Radio Day 2019.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
As regular listeners know, myself and radio activist and friend Brian Green are developing the Irish Pirate Radio Audio Archive, pirate.ie, a free and open archive of historical pirate recordings and interviews with those involved. We're concentrating at the moment on the 1980s, when a large, powerful and diverse pirate radio sector developed throughout the country before legislation in 1989. One person who has an enormous sound and paper archive of that time is Ian Bigger, a long-time pirate enthusiast and one-time pirate broadcaster from Scotland, who spent several years in Ireland working at stations in Louth and Cork. Ian now lives in Harrogate in England, and we went there recently to talk to him about his memories of Irish pirate radio. Today we bring you part of an extended interview with Ian. In this section, he describes his involvement with pirate radio in Cork.
So I was back home in Scotland after being in Drogheda, and I got a call from Eric Vaughan, who in turn had a call from Colm McParlin, who was a Boyne Sound engineer, saying that there was a station opening in Cork and would I be interested in joining? And I said, well, yeah, I am. Obviously, I thought about going to the Voice of Peace with Don Allen, but that never came around. So I thought, well, yeah, we'll go to Cork. Eric said there was money being paid, which was good, obviously. And did I know anybody else who was interested in joining? So I mentioned a friend of mine called Paul Graham, who had just come back from Ireland from a station called WABC in Ballyhadrine. I phoned him and he was interested in going across. So we decided we'd head over to Cork, or Cork City, as I thought it was. So we got over there. I arrived. Eric picked me up at Cork train station after getting the train down from Dublin. And we headed off to the country. It was actually to Ballycotton in County Cork, which is a lovely seaside village, about 20 odd miles from Cork City itself, and that's where the station had been set up.
And this was ERI.
This was ERI, or East Side Radio, as it was at the time. It had been set up as a summer project for the family's children. Just to keep them busy during the summer months. It was the O'Connor family who owned some engineering businesses in Cork, and they had a summer house in Ballycott, and this is where the radio station had been set up. Comet Parlin had heard the broadcast and gone over to visit them, and had said to them, well, you know, we can make this into a commercial venture if you're interested. I think the FM transmitter originally had come from Cork City Local Radio and hadn't worked that well, so Cork, I think, supplied them with a new FM and also one of his medium wave transmitters, which was a couple of hundred watts. So it given quite good coverage across East Cork. So we arrived, myself and Eric and Paul Graham, and we started doing programmes from Ballycotton. Now, the good thing about the O'Connor family was that they were quite progressive in their approach to things. They could see how you need to invest in something to then recoup from that. So they were very much interested in expanding the radio station, and they were quite open to any suggestions that we might come up with. So one of the first things we thought is, well, why not get a better transmitter, increase the coverage, and be able to, you know, set yourself in a more stable commercial footing. So yeah, they were up for that. One of the guys had a contact in America, a company called Besco, who sold transmitters to the likes of Radio Caroline. From there, they purchased a 5-kilowatt Continental Electronics medium wave transmitter, which was duly shipped over from the States without too much problems, if I remember rightly, because Mrs. O'Connor had some contacts in the department, so it was imported quite easily into the country, and then set up at White's Cross, just outside Cork City, near Glanmire. The transmitter was installed there and fired up on air round about September 1982.
And that was a big investment, and wouldn't have been cheap, and 5 kilowatts was a significant power to be putting out on AM.
It was, you know, and it took the station beyond just Cork, because with that kind of power, you're going to cover sort of parts of Waterford. In fact, I can remember, and I still sort of reminisce with Andy Linton, who was working at Southside Radio, Suicide Radio at the time. We put the big transmitter on 1332 kilohertz. ERI normally use 1305. We put the big transmitter in 1332, which was Suicide's frequency. And within about half an hour, Andy was on the phone to us saying, hey, you'll have to move, you know, you're blotting us out in Waterford, you know. So that transmitter was covering Waterford, it was getting into Limerick, Tipperary, really covering, you know, as the station was intended to, covering most of Munster, you know, with that kind of power. So they invested in a transmitter, they invested in new studio equipment, cart machines and the like, some new jingles from the States as well. So really, from being a summer project for the kids, it turned into to a commercial radio station all within 2 or 3 months.
And did the studio move from Ballycotton at this time as well?
It did, yeah. It was hastened by the fact that somebody was jamming us. We were linking, which was daft when you think about it, we're linking on FM from Ballycotton to Cork City, which is quite a distance really, you know, 20-odd miles linking. So somebody, and we don't know who to this day, decided to jam the link, which kind of hastened our move from Ballycotton to Cork City. So, yeah, we set up some studios in Porter Cabins, very much like Sunshine Radio, next to the O'Connor's house in White's Cross. And that's where ERI was really set up and really got into the business in anger, you know.
And it was a pretty significant station, you know, similar to perhaps to some of the Dublin Super Pirates at the time.
It was, yeah. Both in the real key ingredient that ERI had was the O'Connors knew how to market it, and they were willing to invest in marketing the station. And they did all sorts of stuff, like you know, they did loads of road shows. You had people out on Patrick's Bridge in Cork, you know, handing out leaflets. They actually had a PR team who wore an ERI uniform, you know, and went around the city promoting the station. They knew exactly what they were doing, you know, and they were. And I've said this to Joe O'Connor, and you know, latterly, it was a pleasure to work for them because they really had the best interests of the station in mind, you know.
Would it be right to think that paralleling Dublin and Cork, that ERI was Nova and South Coast was Sunshine?
Pretty much so, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that's probably a good comparison. South Coast had started maybe about 3 months earlier than ERI, with some Cork guys who had broken away from mainly Radio City, I think, along with some guys from Dublin. A couple of English guys as well. Keith York was one of the sort of main, he was engineer there. So that there was a big rivalry, and that goes back to your earlier point about socialising with the station staff. As I mentioned, in Drogheda, we didn't really do that. In Cork, we did. We had a few good nights there, which was very much frowned upon by the O'Connor family, you know, for whatever reason. They didn't like us socialising with the South Coast guys, which we did probably most weekends, you know. But, and then probably the worst thing that happened was, I think I was doing the breakfast show one morning about 7:30, and Keith York and Terry Vicani, who was the South Coast engineer, arrived up at ERI, you know. They were in the studio with me, and of course Joe O'Connor then walks into the studio with a couple of South Coast guys in there, you know. So that didn't go down too well, but we were mates, you know, and we didn't see why that kind of ruling should affect our friendship, you know.
Apart from the desire of the owners to make some money out of these projects, and like all ventures and in kind of business, there's risks attached and you might not make those millions that you wanted to make. Was there something else that was driving all of these stations to be coming on in this very short period of time? Was there a copycat mentality between cities and what was going on, the loopholes being exploited? Was there something greater than just individual business people wanting to have operations?
I think Cork City and Cork people would see themselves as being very individual and very different from Dublin. So I don't think they would model themselves in Dublin at all, you know. I think in the case of South Coast and in the case of ERI, they were purely financial money-making ventures, you know. They were out to make money, using radio as a platform for that. And they did, you know, and especially in the case of ERI, because they did it right. You know, they invested money to make money, and by golly, they made money, you know. They made a lot of money. I'd say ERI financially was probably the most successful station in Ireland, you know, more successful than Nova. It was on the air longer than Nova, you know. So, you know, but by simple mathematics, you would say they make more money. Okay, I mean, Dublin's a bigger city, but, you know, the agency ads are agency ads, you know, in Cork or Dublin, you know, so they're going to make a lot of money.
Would it be fair to say that your Cork journey and ventures down there were your most fruitful?
From a professional point of view, definitely, yeah. Because, you know, it was like working, not to, you know, decry Boyneside Radio in any way, because Boyneside Radio was a good regional radio station. But in Cork City, we were working, you know, using, you know, professional equipment. We had a professional radio station as a rival with professional presenters. So you've got to be in top of your game in that situation, you know. So, yeah, from that point of view, I think, you know, the Cork experience was for me the best one, yeah. For that.
So the raids in Dublin in 1983, Radio Nova was raided, Sunshine was raided in Dublin. This had a chill effect on many other stations who closed down voluntarily. There was jamming around the same time and so on. How did that play out in Cork at around the same period for ERI and South Coast Radio?
Yeah. Well, I think there was some trepidation. South Coast did close down temporarily, but returned to the air, you know, when it seemed that the teams weren't sort of moving down to Cork City. There were rumours that after they'd dealt with Nova and Sunshine, they were going to move down to Cork and deal with the stations there. South Coast closed down temporarily, very short period of time. ERI, the story was quite different because, now I'd left ERI by this time, but a very good friend of mine to this day, Paul Graham, was station manager there at the time, and he'd received a tip-off from somebody that the teams were going to come down to Cork. So he took it upon himself to remove the equipment from the studio. Wires were just cut and everything sort of taken away and hidden. Now, unfortunately, this had an adverse effect on his relationship with the people at ERI, who thought it was the wrong thing to do. Robin, the engineer, who was a good friend of ours as well, he took exception to the fact of, you know, the act had been carried out in sort of dismantling the studio. And really, you know, Paul Graham feels to this day that that was the catalyst for him to leave ERI, which he did just a week or so later, you know. So, it did have a big effect on the station. I think ERI was off the air for several days until they sort of put everything back together again, you know. But there was a lot of fear at the time, but ultimately I think they just brushed it off and got on with things once it had all died down, you know.
And there was never any raid on ERI itself, as far as I know.
No, there's never any raid on ERI or South Coast. ERI was closed by an injunction, I think, about 1986. I can't remember what the circumstances were, but they were off the air for a period of time. But no actual raid by the department, no.
And, of course, during all of this time, you were building up your own archive. So going right back to, I suppose, the 70s,
yeah.
You were recording on cassette. You were pulling in these distant Irish stations, low power initially and then higher power. So you have a huge amount of material, very important resource. So tell us about how this began and how you built this up over the years and what kind of equipment you were using and so on.
Well, I suppose a so-called anorak has a certain kind of psyche, you know. I mean, they like documents, they like audio recordings. I think it's just a natural part of being someone who's interested in radio, you know. So I just started to build that archive, yeah, probably starting in the mid-70s. It covers, like, the Irish pirates. It covers offshore radio as well. I mean, I've probably got thousands of hours of recordings from each. It just started by exchanging cassettes with people in Ireland, people in Europe, and just building up the collection, you know. And I suppose my fear is, and why I think, you know, the whole initiative of archiving this is good, that, you know, when I eventually pop this mortal coil, it'll end up in a skip, you know. As has happened with a lot of people who have unfortunately died and their archive has just been disposed of by a family who don't really know the importance of it, you know, and the significance of it, not just from a personal point of view, but from a social point of view, from a development point of view. I mean, that there's much more to the whole radio thing than just listening to it, you know. I think Ireland's a good example of that because, I mean, I've got a view. One of the reasons why radio was so important in Ireland, or pirate radio in the 80s, is it formed a part of escapism, you know. Because, I mean, Ireland during that period, and, you know, and the sort of mid to late 70s before that, was having some quite trying times, you know. So the fact that radio was there, that was playing music, there were these, you know, larger than life guys presenting programs. I think for a lot of people of various ages, it did provide that escapism for them to get away the worries of the day, whether they be unemployed or whatever, you know, and just to lose yourself in music and the crack that was coming over the radio at the time, you know. So I think the Irish Pirates played an important part of the social development of Ireland during the 70s and 80s, you know.
Was that part of the attraction of it for you, do you think?
No, I mean, I'll be blatantly honest. The attraction for me was to go and do radio and be paid for it, you know. I mean, that's what lured me over there. I suppose it's only natural that when you go to a country like Ireland, and you know the personality that Ireland has, it's going to become more than that, because obviously I've developed a big interest in the country itself, you know, and the culture of the country. And I mean, you know, for the past 20, 30 years, you know, I mean, you know, Ireland and it's formed, you know, a big part of my life, you know. So I think that developed over a period of time, you know, and just, you know, an interest in Irish history and all things Irish. So, but no, going back to, you know, for me, radio was to go there and present and get experience, you know. That was one of the big attractions for me, that, you know, experience that I couldn't get at that time in Scotland, you know.
Was there anything in particular as an outsider coming from Scotland to Ireland that you noticed about the country as you arrived, and then by the time you had left had changed, and in any way what radio had contributed to that change?
I suppose Ireland has been developing, you know, over a number of years, you know, your sort of views are changing. I suppose radio might have helped people to open their minds just a little bit, you know. I mean, radio does do that. I mean, you know, you could consider, and you know, you correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a certain maybe insular mindset in Ireland at that time, you know, and you know, radio coming on and this the gung ho having a sort of pop at authority aspect of pirate radio maybe helped people just to open their minds a little bit, to say, hang on a sec, this is okay, this is fine, you know, we can have a sort of a bit of a revolt against authority. We can do things that maybe we're not quite supposed to do. We're not harming anybody, but we're not following the official line, you know, that we've been taught by our parents, been taught at school, been taught by the clergy or whatever, you know. We're doing things a little bit differently. And I think radio probably helped just to open that a little bit, yeah.
So you said you got into radio, you know, quite frankly, because you wanted to get paid experience in it. Yeah. But looking back now, you can see the significance of all of this stuff historically. So what for you stands out from your archive of all of the thousands of hours of recordings that you have? What do you think are the particularly important aspects there? Are there any particular recordings that stand out for you?
Well, I suppose a lot of the closed down recordings, they do. I mean,
that's the close down of the 31st of December 1988.
Yeah, yeah. But even before that, during the time of the raids and the support that Nova got from people, you know, I mean, you know, Herbert Street was just swarming with faces at that time, you know, and people were raising their voices to say to the government, hang on a sec, we don't like what you're doing here, you know. Maybe we shouldn't be doing this, and, you know, voicing our disapproval, but we're going to do it anyway, you know. So I think the close down certainly. Kiss FM in Monaghan in December 1988, when that was going off the air. I mean, there's a theory by one of the guys who started Kiss FM that it really helped to bring people together in the north, you know. And it may well be the case, it may not, you know. It may have had a part in that. I mean, it was non-religious, you know. It was non-sectarian. It was just playing good pop music that everybody would like, you know. So, I mean, you know, pirate radio, I think, contributed in some way, big or small, to the cultural development of Ireland, you know, in the 70s and 80s.
Last question for me then. What do you think of what Irish radio has become today?
Well, I'll give you a good example of that. I was over in Cork last summer on holiday and tuning around, as you do, while driving around Cork and looking for a station. 10 o'clock, half 10 in the morning, playing music, and couldn't find one. So I think my view is, in a lot of ways, Irish radio has stagnated a bit. It sounds, a lot of the stations sound like ILR did in the UK in the 1970s, which was one of the reasons why I came to Ireland in the first place. So I think it's gone full circle in a way. All that real kind of vision around radio and how radio should be, I think, has disappeared. We've got radio consultants coming in, you know, with a very narrow view on what radio should sound like. I mean, I think you're talking to friends who are still in the industry. I mean, some of the stuff the consultants come up with is good, it's sensible, but I think in a lot of ways it's stifled radio and the development of radio. So no, I you know, apart from the few pirates I've heard in Ireland, which some of them are still okay. In Cork, there was a couple of good stations on, very tight stations playing music. But generally, I wasn't that impressed.
And very last word for me: why then do you think that the pirates in Ireland persist? Because there are still some, and you log them, and you talk about them, and so on.
I think there'll always be a need for pirate radio. There's always a need for someone to buck the system, to do something different, to fly the flag, to switch a transmitter on, and just say, well, okay, you know, we've got choice in radio now, but choice could be greater, and we're going to give you that greater choice.
Ian Bigger, formerly of ERI Radio in Cork, talking to myself and Brian Green about his involvement in Irish radio and the importance of preserving pirate archives. You can hear the full interview at pirate.ie. And that's it for the March edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. We'll be back on the first Monday in April with more radio news and features. But in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and facebook.com/wirelessflirt. All our programmes are also available online at wirelessflirt.wordpress.com. Until next month, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.